Heavy shelling in a number of regions of Ukraine as residents hunker down for what's still to come.
This new big assault by Russian forces has already begun.
Plus, NATO leaders pledge continued vigilance.
The important thing now is to support Ukraine. And then no one can tell exactly when this war ends. But when it ends, we need to ensure that history doesn't repeat itself.
And later in the program, the war's impact on the education of millions of Ukrainian children.
That loss of a basic sense of safety really does have a catastrophic effect on learning, on emotional development, social development. And unfortunately, UNICEF knows this.
Today is Tuesday, February 28th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. Ukraine's northeastern city of Kupiansk has been bombed daily since the end of January when Russian forces started a new offensive to conquer the industrial Donbas region. Kupiansk in the Kharkiv Oblast is key to Russia's desire to control the whole east of Ukraine. Now an estimated 16,000 people are struggling to keep living in the city, with some yearning to leave. Jan Boyshot reports.
After months of enduring Russia's year-old war in Ukraine, a woman by the name of Nina says she has given up.
We simply didn't expect anything like this.
For the past weeks, the bombing has been too constant, too hard, too close. Ivan Azanov is part of Kupiansk's civil defense forces. He was on the phone, working to evacuate Nina.
This person wants to be evacuated. Can you write down the details? She can't use her phone. I'm passing the phone.
Good afternoon. Can I go on Monday?
1 week before this war entered its second year, Nina decided to leave the life she had built here since 1993, when she came from a small village on the Romanian border.
The bombings never stop. I'm still alive because a power plant was close to us, which protected us. But now, I don't know anymore. It's time to go.
The Russians have been bombing Kupiansk daily for the past month, sometimes all day long. Destruction is everywhere, and many here believe the city may be doomed to a fate like Bakhmut, where Russians and Ukrainians have been fighting street by street, house by house, for months. Kupiansk is a strategic city. It is an important railway hub connecting the entire northeast of Ukraine with Russia. But bombs are only part of the problem here.
The local citizens are on the edge of a humanitarian catastrophe, have lost their jobs, and have no means to live anymore.
Ivan Azanov oversees civil defense in Kupiansk. He says promises of help from the United Nations and other Western organizations have yet to arrive.
Things are becoming worse. We need the help from our Western partners to hold and don't let them to move further.
Local humanitarian aid organizations have tried to offer some relief to the Kupiansk's 16,000 residents. In this kitchen, 6,000 meals are served every day. For many, this is the only food they get. Andriy Davidov runs the kitchen.
The problem is not food. The problem is money. People have lost their jobs.
Without money, there's simply no easy way out. Many are forced to stay. Larissa Polyakova and her father, Ivan Zaika, have lived in a basement for 3 months.
There are no jobs. I'm living on my dad's pension.
Larissa once worked in a small clothing factory, but like most businesses around here, the factory closed. Her father is almost blind following a stroke and can barely sleep with the constant sound of artillery.
He keeps saying that to live like this, it's better to be dead.
Not far from there, a man ignores the sound of artillery and tries to catch a fish at this frozen river. Somehow, life goes on in Kupiansk. Ian Boesha for VOA News, Kupiansk, Ukraine.
Ukrainian tanks and soldiers train daily on the country's northeastern front as tensions rise. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The troops throw grenades and fire machine guns at targets, but it's only a drill. However, the sound of a real war rumbling just a short distance away underscores the high stakes in this part of Ukraine. Military officials say a much-anticipated Russian offensive has already started, with fighting that could determine the next phase of this war. Observers say time is of the essence, so speed and cohesion is the goal of the exercises. Grueling artillery battles have stepped up in recent weeks in the vicinity of Kupiansk. The strategic town is on the eastern edge of Kharkiv province, by the banks of the Oskil River. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A Ukrainian military official is describing the situation around the city of Bakhmut as extremely tense, highlighting an area that's been subject to heavy fighting between Ukrainian and Russian forces in Ukraine's Donetsk province. I spoke with VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova for an update on what appears to be escalating shelling in a number of cities.
Yeah, so very heavy fightings, very heavy hostilities continue in the east part of the country, at the east front line, and particularly around the city of Bakhmut, but also heavy shellings happening in general, a lot of heavy shellings happening in different areas of the Donetsk region, and Ukrainian general staff confirmed that Russian forces intensify the shelling, intensify their actions in that area, and also increase their presence in that area. So General Staff of Ukraine reported that there are more Russian manpower coming to that area and concentrated in that area. So, and as we already discussed previously, and as was already reported by the head of Ukrainian military defense, Mr. Budanov, and also by Ukrainian military officials, that basically this new big assault by Russian forces has already begun, and it already happening in the east part of the country, in the east front lines.
Well, the new offensive didn't fully kick in when it was expected to?
Actually, yes. In terms of the massive shelling, Ukrainians expected another massive shelling on the 23rd and 24th of February because of the one-year anniversary. Oh, I'm just a second. It's air raid siren. I just need to switch off the notification. Just a second. Yeah, so Ukrainians expected another massive shelling on the 24th and 23rd and 24th of February, marking one-year anniversary of the full-scale invasion, but it didn't happen. However, today, Ukrainian the representation of the south area of the Ministry of Defense confirmed that they can report on the increase of Russian actions in the Black Sea, particularly that they can see at least 5 rocket launchers in the sea, and this including 2 under the water, and general amount of possible caliber missiles that these rocket launchers could have on board could reach up to 32 missiles. And actually, just now as we are talking, air raid siren is on in Kyiv, and it might be that it's not only in Kyiv. So basically, this information is another sign for possible massive shelling that actually might still happen. So everyone is on the alert.
VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin today ordered his FSB security service officials to tighten control of the border to increase activity to counter, according to Reuters, what Putin described as sabotage groups entering the country from Ukraine. He also instructed the FSB to improve security in 4 eastern regions of Ukraine that Russia has partially seized and officially annexed, a move that countries have condemned as illegal. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg is in Finland today, a visit that comes as Finland and Sweden prepare to resume talks next week with Turkey about their bids to join NATO. At a news conference alongside the Finnish Prime Minister, Stoltenberg said NATO allies and partners, including Finland and Sweden, are providing an unprecedented level of military support to Ukraine.
We are not party to the conflict, but we need to remember what this is. This is a war of aggression launched by President Putin against Ukraine. They have the right to defend themselves. That is right, which is enshrined in the UN Charter. And we have the right to help support Ukraine in upholding the right of self-defense.
He also said NATO has increased its military presence in the eastern part of the alliance, also in the Baltic region, in an effort to prevent the conflict from becoming a full-fledged war between Russia and NATO.
The important thing now is to support Ukraine, and then no one can tell exactly when this war ends. But when it ends, we need to ensure that history doesn't repeat itself, that President Putin cannot continue to attack neighbors. And therefore, we need to strengthen the military capabilities of Ukraine, but also look for frameworks that can ensure that President Putin, Russia, doesn't invade Ukraine yet another time.
And Stoltenberg said that NATO members have agreed Ukraine will eventually become a part of the alliance, but the immediate issue is to ensure that Ukraine prevails as a sovereign nation. 1 year after the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and a cascade of international sanctions against Russia, the country's economy is feeling the impact, although its effect has not been as fast as Western powers had hoped. Marcus Horton narrates this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau.
Walking on Moscow streets, one may think that this is not the capital of a country at war. In stores, we can find American-designed next-generation phones, albeit at prices 30% more expensive than in the West. There are no visible shortages, and Russia can thank the traditional allies who have helped it dodge sanctions. Businessman Dmitry Potapenko. He says there are four countries that continue to sell to Russia, whether legally or not. Iran, China, Turkey, and India. But the sanctions have succeeded in hitting entire sectors, such as Russia's automobile industry, whose sales domestically have fallen 80%. The Russian civil aviation sector has also taken a hit, cut off from virtually all international routes. Perhaps more importantly, Russian airlines find it almost impossible to get spare parts. Russia's government has intervened with a so-called parallel imports program to prevent shortages by allowing Russian companies to more freely buy products from suppliers via third countries. Natalia Zubarovich is an economic analyst. She says consumers now have worse products, more expensive, and with fewer supplies, but they have them. This policy has ensured that basic necessities are not lacking, which on the street translates into a feeling, real or not, of normality. Muscovites we interviewed told us they notice little, if anything, has changed. She says the situation has not changed. Perhaps it is more difficult to find some imported items, but nothing important. We have everything. He says, I think nothing has changed. We have already been under sanctions on other occasions. We are living this period calmly. He says, at the moment, the sanctions are not noticeable, at least not here in Moscow. But I think they will begin to be noticed from this summer. It has been a year since the start of the full-scale war, and the citizens of Moscow who spoke to us appeared not to be overly concerned. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Kazakhstan for a series of meetings with top Central Asian diplomats and at a news conference expressed his gratitude for the shelter and diplomatic approach offered by the Central Asian nation, a former Soviet republic, amid the strife in Ukraine.
We applaud Kazakhstan for continuing to host more than 200,000 Russian citizens who fled their country after President Putin launched his war. And I want to thank the people of Kazakhstan for generously providing food, clothing, medicine, other humanitarian supplies to Ukraine, including setting up those yurts of invincibility in Kyiv and Bucha, where Ukrainians can find warmth and respite from the war.
Blinken also made a point to say those who have traditionally been in Moscow's orbit can't afford to ignore the threats posed by Russian aggression to not only their territory, but to the international rules-based order. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. A year into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, UNICEF says the conflict has disrupted the education of more than 5 million children. To learn more about the programs in place to help children get back to learning in Ukraine and elsewhere, Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller spoke with UNICEF spokesperson James Elder in Lviv over WhatsApp, beginning with their conversation by asking about the impact the war has had.
I think you'd have to say that the devastating impact that this war is having on the mental health and well-being of Ukrainian boys and girls, remembering that, like all children around the world, they went in and out of classrooms much more out than in during 2 years of COVID. And they were just, you know, coming up for air, thinking there'd be some normality, time to go back into school, time to see friends, to play, to learn. And suddenly this seemingly endless attack. So those children have become aware that the world is unstable, unpredictable, and can be a really terrible place. And that loss of a basic sense of safety really does have a catastrophic effect on learning, on emotional development, social development. And unfortunately, UNICEF knows this. We know this from our time in places like Syria and Yemen, and we know how critical the classroom is, even in a time of war, to avoiding longer-term mental health issues and depression and anxiety. So that's why UNICEF still does everything to create any form of education opportunities. But a lack of schooling on top of bombardments and the terror of a year of war, that is a dire mental health challenge for the children of Ukraine.
And as students in Ukraine are starting to go back to the classroom, we saw that earlier this year when the academic year officially got underway, there are, of course, still significant shellings taking place in different cities. So whether or not students can actively go back to the classroom on a regular basis depends on where they are. But the goal is, of course, to get students back in that learning environment. So what is UNICEF doing to help facilitate that to the students who are still in Ukraine?
So UNICEF's work on education, because we see it as a life-saving response. So it's up there with, you know, whether we're doing medical treatments or safe water supply to millions and millions of children. And for education, it's been education supplies. So more than 1 million children supplied with education materials. It's been working very closely with the Ministry of Education to ensure that there's good online learning. That blended form that, again, children had during COVID is happening again here. Sometimes children go into a classroom and then the next week they don't. So making sure the online learning is good, making sure those children who go to school are safe. And in Ukraine, it's not so much on how many desks there are in a classroom, it's on the capacity of a bunker. So I'd not seen this anywhere in UNICEF before, but we reinforce bunkers. We make sure that, you know, in bunkers and basements for children, there is lighting, there is sanitation, all those things, because schools are restricted in how many children they can take based on how many kids they can get into the bunker. So those whole range of things, classroom time is always the best, but there are shared, you know, seatings and times at school. So in that case, it's blended learning, it's online learning, and also online learning where children are together in a space, maybe three or four of them at a home, at a community center, again, just to avoid that isolation when they learn.
What about the efforts to help students who are displaced, who are in other countries, whether they be in Europe or elsewhere?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's been, again, working very closely with all those governments of neighboring countries as far afield as Ireland, who have absorbed children. It's a mix of supporting those governments in terms of curriculum, so that children can both be learning languages, learning the language of a Holland or learning the language of of an England, but at the same time have access to their own curriculum, which is very important, particularly for older children, because when they come back, they don't want to feel that they've missed out on a year of learning. Now, the hope, of course, is the many parents I've spoken to in neighboring countries who find a glass half full because their child will learn another language, which is absolutely correct. And yet they're concerned that they don't miss out on Ukrainian curriculum. So there's been a balance of getting that right as well, because everyone wants to come home, because the longer they're away, no matter where they are, no matter where they are learning, no matter which education system they're a part of, you know, these children are also not with their father. So families have been torn apart, which of course makes any child's education more difficult and the strain on mothers as well.
UNICEF spokesperson James Elder spoke with Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller. Vitaly Antishuk was a soldier in the Ukrainian army who died during a Russian missile strike in the Zaporizhia in May. He left behind his wife, Yulia, and their six-year-old daughter, Alyssa. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb met with them in Warsaw, Poland, where they fled to escape the war.
It was an incomprehensible connection. We watched each other grow up.
Yulia Antishuk met the love of her life when they were just kids. After graduating from college, Yulia and Vitaly got married. He joined the army. She started teaching. And then came Alyssa.
He always talked to Alyssa the whole period while she was in my tummy. He said that she would have eyes like his, lips like mine. He taught her to be sporty, to ride a bicycle. He had no other hobby.
And he was always little Alyssa's protector.
He was kind. He supported me. He hugged me all the time, played with me, and taught me how to fight.
But their family was ripped apart when Russia invaded Ukraine. Yulia and Alyssa spent 12 days huddled in a basement while Vitaly fought for his country.
She started having nervous breakdowns. She was constantly picking her fingers like this. And we made a decision that it was better to be in a place where she would be able to have an active life, where she wouldn't be afraid and could get better somehow.
This is the last photo they ever took together. Yulia fled with Alyssa here to Warsaw. But not long after, Vitaly was killed in a missile strike. Alyssa, too young to fully comprehend this war, has taken the loss hard.
She is constantly nervous, constantly stressed, and misses her dad very much. She began to draw pictures where Vitaly is no longer standing next to us, where he is above us. And when she asked me if he would come back, I had to say no. It was very difficult.
Yulia and Alyssa both seek counseling at Warsaw's UN Refugee Agency Center. Alyssa gets to play there with other Ukrainians and talk to kids who speak her language. They're supported by a foundation called Children of Heroes, a charity that aids Ukrainian children who have lost one or both parents in the war. Sadly, CEO Dan Pasco says Alyssa is one of thousands.
There is between 20 and 50,000 children in this situation right now. As of today, we have 3,488 children under our support programs, and we are adding 50 children per day.
Yulia says this war has turned their future, once so bright, into something painful without Vitaly.
You're still wearing your wedding ring, aren't you?
Yes, because I'm not ready to let him go.
She says her main focus is keeping Alyssa's happy memories of Vitaly in her heart, in hopes they can soon return to the homeland he died fighting for. Carla Babb, VOA News, Warsaw.
And that'll do it for us today. Until next time, I'm Lori London. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.